I'm John Cain, and this is Resistance Radio. I want to thank you for joining me. Not airing in Washington this week, because that would be tomorrow, which is International Women's Day. So I'm going to talk about, and they're doing special programming in D.C. for tomorrow, and I know WBAI is as well, but I'm going to take this opportunity to talk about that today. But first, let me remind people that we are listener-supported radio. We depend almost entirely on your contributions to keep these radio stations, and in this case, WBAI, not just afloat, but operating. So if you like any of the programming, you must support the radio station. And if you like this programming, I'm hoping that you'll support this radio station to keep keep my slot available to me and allow me to keep you informed and to keep probably a unique opinion, position, view of issues coming to you from a place you won't get it anywhere else. So I do ask that you go to their pledge line, and you can call that at 212-209-2950. Make a contribution of any size. Become a WBAI buddy, which I would love to sign a bunch of those up. And, you know, again, my contribution to the station via you, the listener, is one of the ways I secure my space on their broadcast grid. So, again, 212-209-2950. If you become a WBAI buddy, you can do that by just doing anything, even something modest, $5, $10 a month. And that'll come off of your credit card or your checking account. You'll provide the information. You can provide that over the phone, or you can go online to give2wbai.org. And do it that way as well. Look, you can do a one-time donation, and I would certainly appreciate and recommend you do that if that's what works best for you. But if you want to do something modest on a monthly basis, then by all means, become a buddy. Become my buddy, the buddy of the station, and I greatly appreciate it. So let me get into it. And look, these special months and these special holidays and these, you know, sometimes there's congressional resolutions that get passed, or the states do them in their, or the cities do them in their city councils, you know, and it's all fine and good to give recognition, you know, to anybody, but certainly people who are marginalized, and women, I think, fit that category as marginalized people. Until they make as much money as men, there's no way to say it any other way. But I've got to tell you, it's hard for me to feel like this is a moment to celebrate women when women are dying at levels that are almost historic. I mean, I think about Israel and their campaign against Palestinians. And look, they can say it's all about God or it's all about Hamas all they want, but the amount of killing of women and children is so disproportionate that, I mean, how do we as people on the globe pretend we can sit here and honor women when we know women are dying at that rate, or that we know women and children are being denied safe refuge in many countries, but including the United States? I mean, to the extent that barbed wire is being, you know, dragged across rivers to prevent people from seeking safety, from seeking, you know, a safe life. And when you consider that the vast majority, I mean, the overwhelming majority of people in the United States, their origins come from immigration themselves. And yet they will deny women and children. And look, I know men are being killed in Gaza, and I know men are being denied, you know, refugee status and asylum and all that. The disproportionate victims of these harsh realities, and let's be clear, it is men who put these things in place. It's men that have sit in that oval that sit in that Oval Office and always have been. And so it's men who are making these decisions about the lives and the safety of women and children. So I got to tell you, part of my issue as, you know, as I start to see, you know, the memes and, you know, and the almost the celebratory tone of coming into International Women's Day, I'm sorry. This is tough. It is tough. I mean, and of course, as a Native person, I can't ignore the fact that the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and children still persists. So the fact that the United States will try to prop up the few wealthy women who make it by a man's standards, that's not the same thing as celebrating women. Because if you look at the numbers in terms of economic disparity, women are, they make less than men. And of course, they are, you know, they suffer all kinds of, you know, other issues at the hands of men. It's hard to suggest that women are truly celebrated in the U.S. culture, in American culture. Because they aren't. I mean, and everything from the policies affecting, you know, maternity leave and, you know, the policies, you know, affecting women in terms of reproductive rights. It is impossible to sit here with a straight face and talk about how great America is for women. Now, granted, I know there are places that are worse. And I'm not suggesting that there aren't. But when I think about the tragic lives that so many women have to experience because of American policy, including Native women, and, you know, and again, missing and murdered Indigenous women, it's a thing. And I'll talk a little bit more about why it's a thing. But how can we sit there and say this? You know, and again, not only do you prop up a few, you know, let's throw an Oprah in there or talk about how successful Taylor Swift is. Well, that's fine, but they aren't the vast majority of women. And trust me, they're getting Oprah's still stuck being a black woman in a society that isn't really kind to black women. And Taylor Swift now is getting caught into the culture wars of right versus left. It doesn't matter that her roots are in country music. That's not even giving her any say. And she's dating a football player. You'd think that would be this. I mean, you'd think the right would be right there with her. But no. She might endorse Joe Biden. So, you know, let's spin some conspiracy theories about that. And, you know, the other thing is you prop up women into these positions. Oh, yeah, we'll put Condoleezza Rice as a, you know, in a cabinet position. We'll put Deb Haaland in a cabinet position. We'll elevate a few women to be judges. Yeah, how do you think they get there? They get there by for the most part, performing to a man's standards. Women are propping these women up. And I'm not going to get into a whole lot of condemning every woman who's been propped up. Look how they rule. I mean, I know sometimes people get tired of me bringing up somebody like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But they toe the line with the right and the left. Why? Because that's what it requires to get into that position in the first place. And then when you get there, you cling on to it. You hang on to it until your dying days. And you know, so this is the reality. Women are not being embraced for what women bring to a society. The only ones who get elevated are the ones who can, you know, carry the water of men. So, you know, if you truly want to honor women, then you need to honor all women. Not just those ones you want to put on a poster. Not just the ones that you've been able to alter their history enough. I mean, it cracks me up when I see people promoting, you know, some of these folks like Maya Angelou and so many other women who really were standing for something, and they do the same thing to her and they did to Martin Luther King. They kind of whitewash what she represented. Reggie, I know that you're there, and if you want to weigh in on any of this stuff, you know, please feel free to do so. Because, you know, the more I kept thinking about, and look, I'm not upset at all. Like on WPFW, I'm preempted tomorrow, and that's fine. They'll do a good job, I'm sure. But, I just think about where the global society is on really celebrating women. And I got to tell you, we got a lot of work to do.
Well, supposedly this is the greatest country in the world. And you would think that a country that has such a lofty moniker would like at least set an example of excellence. And last time I checked, it's telling me otherwise.
There was people are quick to, raise the issue about 3/5 of a man, right? What about 3/5 of a man's pay? It just amazes me. It really does amaze me. And again, the reproductive rights issue is just, it's emblematic. Yes, it's an issue all by itself. But the idea of a bunch of, staunchy white men deciding, what a woman's, what a woman is able to do with her body. I mean, and then I look at this. Is it Alabama, the one with the embryo?
That's Alabama, yeah.
I mean, the idea that they want to take these to such an extreme that you're going to take an embryo in a test tube, essentially.
Not even an egg, man.
And you're going to, I could, by that definition, and it's in their state constitution, it's not just a law. I mean, they did a constitutional amendment to declare this. I mean, can you imagine forcing somebody who decided to freeze some embryos or whatever else that, no, now you have to realize that to a full life. I mean, because you did that, and that's why they're all this controversy. Now they're trying to pass a law that is supposed to protect, doctors and that kind of thing. But it's still there. It's still in their state constitution. And again, it ain't women passing this stuff.
Nope. Sure is not. I always keep hearing that narrative about the preservation of life and stuff. It seemed like the preservation of pre-life. Once you're alive, well, you seem like you're on your own. But when you're now, I mean, how far are we until they legalize zygotes as children, So the thing is that they're always in the concerning of, for lack of a better term, pre-life rather than life.
See,
once you're alive, that's something else.
I don't even buy that completely because, what they've done is they've taken an issue and they turned it into a political issue. And so,
of course,
they tie in evangelical, Christians into the whole mix and other cultures and that kind of stuff. But I don't think there's even sincerity because I guarantee there's a bunch of these guys, including guys like Herschel Walker, who had no problem paying for an abortion when it was convenient to them.
Oh, absolutely.
Steve Garvey, baseball player who's running for a Senate seat in California. It's like, what, right. This guy, you can't tell me the way this guy was lushing around and womanizing. I mean, this guy had two women pregnant at one time and then supposedly married a third or something like that. It's like, and you can't tell me that this guy, had some staunch anti-abortion stance when he was getting that call from somebody claiming, that he was going to be a father again. I don't know.
Right.
And he wants to run and claims that his personal feelings are anti-abortion. Although he claims as he's running, he's not going to win, but I mean, it's just another example of some arrogant, man. And I almost said white man, but it's not even just white men. It isn't. So I don't want to make it a racial thing. It's a gender thing. It's a male domination issue, and shame on any of us who are men for not acknowledging more thoughtfully and more thoroughly the rights of women. I mean, it's of course, it isn't just acknowledging the rights. It's what we take. It's what we accept in terms of objectification and not just in television and movie, but in advertisement and all this other stuff, we're okay with it all. I love my wife, and I was attracted to her because she was very attractive, to me, And I'm not going to say anything that would undermine what caught my eye with my wife 42 years ago. I'm not going to suggest that you know that I didn't play into all of that, you know, that male attraction thing. But right. I've also been married for 42 years and faithful for 42 years. And I'm not saying that as some boast. I don't think it was that difficult. But apparently, because some men have this belief that's been etched into them that they, you know, that somehow God created him to disperse his seed amongst as many, you know, people as possible, or whatever the belief is that right. the rationale for people to do some of what they do. I got to tell you, it's just incredible to me.
It is incredible. And, you know, and it also takes the point of, like, even unfairly when you're reading scriptures like that, it's taking the responsibility from the man on what their actions are. You know, if we're going to be really equal about it, you call out the behavior of adults, but somehow men, according to those scriptures that you have just said, or quotes that you just said, it's kind of like a mulligan of sort, you know, it's
yeah,
just like,
yeah, we'll give them a pass. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll
boys
give them
will
a pass
be boys. I mean, it's just, hey, locker room. It's just, know, locker room talk. We're not really, hey, running around grabbing women by their vaginas, as Trump wants.
Don't take it personal.
Yeah.
Don't
yeah.
take it personal. No, oh, of course not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and again, you know, I look at the way some men, you know, again, I'm not going to just, I mean, I can attack Trump and Biden equally here. But when I think about how he treated somebody like Anita Hill, for instance.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
And
yeah.
and yeah. and now you look at a guy like Clarence Thomas, who sits there on the bench, you know, just selling himself to the right in the way he does. I mean, I don't know. Just all of it. I take it all in, and I, you know, and I see, you know, what men on both the right and the left, and how they, you know, how they misrepresent themselves and their so-called moral values. And and I look at women still struggling, you know, and struggling in ways. Not only do they have a whole lot of men who won't accept the responsibility to children, and this isn't a black thing,
right,
or, you know, or
no,
a racial thing. You know, there are more white women on welfare than black women on welfare, just so people are aware here. And part of it oftentimes is, you know, is the amount of deadbeat dads that are out there. And so you have that, and then you have this notion that goes from every place, from the most impoverished communities to, you know, to the White House, with this boys will be boys kind of attitude.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you're absolutely right on that one.
So here's what I want to honor for International Women's Day. I want to honor those women who struggle every single day. I'm not going to honor the ones who are making millions, or who got their judgeships or their cabinet positions, or, you know, wrote their bestsellers. No, you don't need nothing from me. But I mean to tell you, I want to honor the single women raising children. I want to honor the women who have got to bear the scars of sexual abuse, you know, for their entire lives because the society doesn't look after them the way they should. I want to honor the women who struggle. I don't want to honor the women that made it. And so, you know, and I'm not trying to disrespect anybody in the process, but, you know, frankly, if you're living large, you don't need my sentiments. And look, I can't say that anybody is going to be uplifted by my words here today. But all I can tell people is, look, help a homeless person. I mean, do something, you know. And at the risk of being conned out of pocket change, you know, take the chance. Take the chance that you're doing something positive for a human being, for crying out loud. You know, and look, as we see, you know, everything from the immigration problem, you know, and how this becomes such a political football. I mean, you got Trump, who's not in office, almost dictating the policies of an entire party, an entire wing of national government, to destroy any hopes of trying to come up with solutions to, you know, to help, you know, to come up with solutions. And I'm not even suggesting that the Biden solutions were that great in the first place. I mean, I look at what I look at, you know, a mayor like Eric Adams, who's trying to, you know, change the, you know, the sanctuary city laws because he wants to be able to, you know, dump a few people off here and there. And, you know, so even when something gets done that you think is positive or is enshrined, look, there's always going to be people chipping away at it. And look, the crazy part is they try to make it sound like it's always a question of how much it costs. And yet, you know, getting back to this notion of propping up women who have made it, right? Even the women who sit in that billionaire slot, they're doing just as much to create that wider gap between the haves and the have-nots as men are. I mean, I'm not saying there's many of them, but I'm just saying that you can't elevate just a few isolated examples of women, of successful women, and say, oh yeah, see there, in America, even a woman can become a billionaire. No, they can't. I mean, in order for somebody to get there, for one thing, and I talk about this with a lot of Native issues, is when we talk about what Native people have to face for us to kind of make it in a capitalist society that's all around us. And I know that sounds like a terrible thing to even strive for, but at the end of the day, we have to feed ourselves on a Native territory as well. We've got to go to a store. We got to buy the groceries. We don't have food sovereignty or economic self-sufficiency. So we're stuck in the same system that was created. And it's old money that always makes the new money. I mean, in almost every instance. So, I mean, even when you talk about these people that want to claim, you know, the Gates or the, you know, the Zuckerbergs or whatever else, they didn't come from poor families. I mean, come on. And it, you know, and that, so where does that old money come from? Well, it came from slavery. It came from genocide. And one of the things that gets missed, you know, when Native people talk about lands having been lost, much of that land was lost through this whole system of land grants. And, you know, land grant colleges, for instance. These colleges, when people hear about land grant colleges, I don't know, maybe you think that all people think is that a land grant college is a college that is positioned on what was once Native land that was granted to them. No, that's not what land grants mean. Land grants meant that these institutions were granted large tracts of land that they could sell to the highest bidder, that, you know, the highest consumer, so they could fund their endowments. But it wasn't just universities that were doing that. The railroad system, the entire thing that drove the economy of the United States for many, many years. Now, we can kind of diss and scoff at the railroad system today, but it's what helped build the U.S. economy. And those railroads, those tracks weren't just laid through Native territories. There were land grants that funded the railroads. And they don't teach any of this stuff anyplace. So when I look at what created this system of haves and have-nots, it's old money that was where wealth was derived from really unbelievable policy of the United States that took freedom, that took lives, that took land, that took resources. Yeah, and much of that scenario that exists, the poverty that exists on Native territories today, poverty alone is one of the biggest contributors to the missing and murdered Indigenous women issue. Because when we look at our own lives on Native territories as unsustainable, and we become desperate, and sometimes women even more so than men, and they become desperate for any way out, sometimes those ways out are not the bill of goods that they're sold. And that's why we have that contributes in a large way to the fact that women are, you know, not only are they vulnerable in the first place, but the lives that are lived on many of these Native territories makes it, you know, almost, you know, unsustainable, so to the point where, yeah, they'll take some risks to get off the territory, to leave the reservation, as they say. You know, and that's true with other women of color, you know, in living in any, whether it's a ghetto or a reservation, same thing. I mean, that's what exists for many people who have been marginalized. And women feel it harder than anybody. So, I mean, this is kind of what I just want to throw this out there, just because when people are feeling good, maybe I'm here to ruin it. I don't know. When people are feeling good about the idea of celebrating, because I know I've seen it. I've seen the posters, I've seen the memes, and I see the women who are being propped up for International Women's Day are the women who don't need that. It's all the other women who need it, the ones who haven't made it, the ones who are struggling every single day. So that's the tribute that I want to pay. I want to pay tribute to the women who are struggling. And look, I know women who have made it. They had their time that they struggled, and look, they had to endure the idea of living in a man's world, right? All the, you know, their whole life, and look, I'm happy for them. You know, even some of these things that I'm not necessarily that crazy about. Like I said, I spent enough time beating up Deb Haaland for essentially joining the other side by becoming, you know, a cabinet secretary, right? You know, as far as I'm concerned, she doesn't work for us anymore. She works for Joe Biden. She works for the white man in the White House. But I'm not saying that to condemn her. I'm just saying that's our loss. You know, because if she possessed this skill set and these leadership qualities, well, unfortunately, she's not ours anymore. She's theirs. And so, but I'm not condemning her for breaking a glass ceiling. I'm glad for her success, but it's her success. It's not the success for all women. You know, and that's what we see. Every time we see a woman who breaks one of those glass ceilings, say, oh, yeah, we did this for all women. Did you? I mean, and how's that playing out? I mean, and I'm not saying that some women don't think that through and have that what drives them is to do something special that can, you know, create a pathway for other women to follow. And I'm not condemning any woman who's ever had success. I'm not. I'm just more concerned and more, you know, again, I want to pay tribute to the ones who are struggling every single day. Look, I do want to take some calls today. I know I promise it probably more than I deliver. So let me give out the line to call in. This is the studio line in New York. And look, if you're listening on Facebook or any other live stream, I guess, feel free to call. It's 212-209-2877. That's the number to call. And look, if you think I'm a hater for anything I said, let's talk about it. I mean, look, I am not hating on anybody. I just think that the women who need recognition and support and the ones who really need to be celebrated are not the ones who were, who have that success, you know, that it was either granted to them or that they or they managed to, you know, produce for themselves. So again, 212-209-2877. If I said that wrong the first time, let me give it again, just because I may have screwed it up. 212-209-2877. That's the studio line. If you want to, you know, weigh in. And look, as I always say, I may present a topic with each show, but we're not stuck just talking about it. You can bring up anything you want. If you want a suggestion for you know, a future show, if you want to offer one up here online or live on the air, then by all means do so. I appreciate when callers call in and give me their thoughts, their ideas. And so let's do it. So Reg, do we have anybody lined up?
We actually do have someone ready to go.
All right. So let's do that. And caller, what I'm going to do is first, I'm going to ask you to turn your radio down before you jump on with us, because we get a bunch of feedback. And I prefer that you don't use your speaker phone because it sounds better to you, but it doesn't to us. It doesn't come through that well. So I appreciate it if you use your phone directly. I'm going to ask you your first name and where you're calling from, and I promise I won't be stalking you. I just want to refer to you by your name. So caller, you're up first. What's your name and where you're calling from?
Yes, hi. Mayad in the Grotto, and I'm a pro. I don't need your instructions. My radio was long ago turned down.
I think you invented calling radio.
You are right on target. Okay, the only thing that's really missing in your high and just right on consciousness is what happens in so-called left and progressive institutions. The question is, and this might be coming forward, they are right on pace with the oppression. Now let us swallow that and ask what we're going to do about it besides being alarmed and shocked. Okay, that's all my comment today. Thank you for your rant. Very, very appropriate in these times.
Well, I want to thank you, Maya. No, I agree. I mean, part of the thing that I find frustrating is when you look at somebody's life's work, and they do get to a place where they may be in a position to affect change, and then they don't because they do toe the line. And again, I don't want to just single out Ruth Bader Ginsburg all the time, but she's not the only woman who ever served on the Supreme Court. But as much as she was always viewed as the liberal darling, you know, I got to remind people that she made some terrible rulings when it came to Native people. And, you know, and frankly, I think a close inspection of some of the women on the court, and look, and obviously not all of them were nominated by, you know, by the left. I mean, you've got Sandra Day O'Connor and, Amy Coney Barrett or whatever else. So, yeah. So a woman, just by gender alone, isn't going to necessarily go in there and represent, you know, women's rights. And the same thing can be said for women in Congress or in the Senate or anything else. I mean, you know, I know Kirsten Gillibrand was having a tough time the other night when she was trying to do, I assume it was a campaign stop of some sort or whatever. And she was getting beat up for her position on Israel and Gaza. And you know what? We should look. Maybe it's unfair for me to say that we should expect more out of women, but you would think that a woman would bring something different to those offices because of their experience, and not just toe the line once they get there. And so, you know, I'm pretty sure that's what my app was driving at. If I missed that, then I apologize. If we got another caller, why don't we put the next one up?
All right,
caller, you're up next. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Sister.
Hey, good to hear from you.
I'm calling from Manhattan.
All right.
I would like to mention a woman who recently passed at the age of 92. Her name is Charlene Mitchell. Based on Women's History Month, no one mentions her name. She was the first African-American woman to run for the office of the presidency. No one mentions her. No one gives her any accolade. And she died at 92 in a nursing home. No one even said anything, nothing passing and nothing on any radio, left, right, or anything in between. So I would like to mention her and let women know that since they're talking about Women History Month and they want to give accolades, like you said, to people who have made it to the top tier, there are people who are in their own community walking around looking at them every day and who have been just erased and dismissed.
I appreciate that. And look, we all, walk in different circles, and we come into contact with women every day that have done incredible things. And oftentimes it is much more difficult for a woman to do even the humanitarian work that they want to do. I mean, I know once anybody, woman or man or woman, becomes a celebrity, you may have, you know, a little bit more of an opportunity, but most of us aren't that. Mm-hmm. Most of us are not celebrities. Most of us are people just trying to do the work every single day. And, you know, and there isn't enough attention given to the women who are doing that hard work every single day.
Well, thank you. And please mention Charlene Mitchell's name whenever you get a chance.
All right. I'm glad you did so as well. I'll keep that in mind. In fact, I'm going to look it up a little bit and see what more I can find about Charlene Mitchell. I appreciate that. Thank you. All right. Well, that's a great call. I mean, I love hearing, you know, people who are going to, you know, bring up, you know, the people who aren't gaining that notoriety when even on these days that they, you know, that are allegedly put forward to bring attention to, you know, to not just, I mean, I don't know, it's just called Indigenous or International Women's Day. It's not necessarily Women's History Day, is it History Month as well, Reggie?
Yes, there is. Okay. There's one waiting and ready to go.
Is that what? So is this considered? Or when is Women's History Month? Is that now?
Women's History Month is the March. Is the month of March.
Okay.
International Working Women's Day is tomorrow.
Right, and that's tomorrow. Okay, all right. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, by all means, I mean, but it, you know, we have a tendency to, you know, to be drawn to the common and the well-known historical figures,
right?
But there are people, you know, there are people throughout American history and pre-American history that have done, you know, in my culture, when we talk about the Haudenosaunee and the what we call the Guyana Rogoa, the Great Law of Peace, when we talk about what brought our five nations and ultimately six when the Tuscarora joined five nations back together. We tell the story of, they call him the peacemaker, and they talk about Hayawenta. But one of the key figures in our stories is a woman, and we knew her, or she in the story. She's her name is Jugunsese, and she played an integral role in what would become the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois Confederacy. But most people, I mean, I'm going to tell you, most Native people don't even know the full story. I mean, I don't know as much as I should. But I know that. But most people, when they think about Native people, they always there's a tendency to always think about the chiefs. In fact, I've heard people describe Native governance as always the chief system. They never talk about it in its right light, which by translation would be more akin to a clan system, a family system, where there's a woman who is essentially sitting with a responsibility to oversee that clan, not the men. The men are given a title for each family, but it's the women who play, and it's the women who determine we follow our mother in terms of what clan we are and that kind of thing. So, you know, a lot of this stuff gets missed. It gets missed because we have a tendency, and in my history, more recent history since European contact, it's always been the men that got elevated up. And I would think, I would honestly say most of what I think has been a loss to Native people in terms of everything from assimilation to indoctrination and frankly, even many of the, you know, the atrocities committed against our people, you know, men were complicit in some of that because they liked the idea of being elevated by the white man to these positions of authority, even if in our culture the authority was much more evenly distributed between men, women, and, you know, and our communities as a whole. So I'll throw a little Native history in there as well. Do we have another caller on the line, Reg?
Yes, we do.
All right, caller, we'll go to you this time. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Good afternoon. Would that be me?
Yeah, that's you.
Okay, thank you. I've been looking forward to relating something to you for a long time. Call me John. I was in this pertains to a situation in something I experienced in Philadelphia about 30, 35 years ago. It was a gathering of some folks. It was a staging area. And I was there to help out, to drive some people around. And I bent down to pick something up. And it was a beautiful day. I bent down to pick something up. And as I raised my head to look up, a woman walked up, and she was with a man. I'd seen the man before, but all I saw was this fantastically beautiful beaded garb she was wearing. And I knew who the man was. I saw him for his true self. But what happened was, what my experience was, as I closed my eyes, and I sort of went blind. And I had a pained look on my face for about 5 or 6 seconds. Now, that's a long time. I think they probably thought I was having a heart attack or a stroke or something. And my eyes were shut tight. And the only thing I was seeing, everything was dark. And I looked And all I could see, it looked like the top of a building or on top of a mountain, like a building. And on the top of this building, I'll call it a building, was flames coming out. Just magnificent, humongous, terrible flames. And the flames spelled a word. And the word was genocide. I never forgot that, and I never told anybody. And I'm relating that to you.
Did you ever come to know who the woman was?
No. They were staring at me. I think they thought I was sick. They must have thought I was sick.
Now, were you there event that you were there for, that you were participating in?
No.
Okay.
No. Hmm. I was supporting an event planner, and I was there to help her out. And I was probably taking people around somewhere, but that's what happened to me. And I never forgot that. And I looked away as soon as I came to, sort of, and I just stepped away. And they were standing, and they didn't say anything, and I didn't say anything. And I never saw them again, and they never saw me again. But I just wanted to tell you that.
Well, I appreciate that. So I appreciate that.
You take care.
All right. Well, what's interesting about that is that, you know, the word genocide was not a widely used word. And in fact, you know, I sometimes have to remind people that word was not developed to describe what Native people went through. I mean, we've kind of taken that word, which was defined really out of some of what the ethnic cleansing that was happening in Europe. And, you know, post-World War II and that kind of stuff. That's when the word was developed. And it's interesting because the definition of genocide, it sounds like a working handbook for building residential schools. It was about killing a people. It was about physically harming a people. It was about creating conditions that would force a people to cease to exist. It was about sterilization programs. And it was about taking children. All of those things. It was like that. That was like the how-to when it came to what residential schools had become. So when we talk about residential schools being genocide, of course, genocide was something that was a part of, you know, colonization from the start, and not just here on what we call Turtle Island. But it's interesting because that word, when you look at its definition, it sounds like they must have had us in mind when they developed the word, the terminology, and what is considered a war crime, a punishable war crime. And yet, we weren't even a consideration when that word was first being coined, the word was coined, and that crime was being defined by the international community. So it's kind of an interesting situation because there are words that become part of our vernacular. And, you know, the word sovereignty is a word that I think, frankly, we overuse it because I'm not crazy about the word because it suggests somehow a power bestowed by God, which that's kind of not my thing. But I use the word when I redefine it, when I define it for ourselves. And genocide is another one of those words. So for anybody to have that a vision of that word appear in any circumstance, especially in association with seeing a Native woman, that's kind of interesting all by itself. And look, if a woman struck this guy's vision 30 years ago, a Native woman, well, I guess International Women's Day is a good time as anybody to retell a story that hasn't been told. All right, let's go to another caller. Caller, you're up next. What's your name and where are you calling from? Caller, are you there?
Caller, you're on the air.
Yes, my name is Sherilyn, calling from Pennsylvania.
Well, thanks for calling. I appreciate it. And it's good to get a call from PA.
Yes. I wanted to just respond just really quickly on the other caller mentioning Charlene Mitchell, Charlene Alexander Mitchell,
mm-hmm.
As the first black woman candidate for the United States. And I had to take a look really quickly to see that she was that she did die December the 14th of 2022, according to when you look it up here, and that she also supported people like they mentioned Angela Davis,
mm-hmm.
and I guess she has lots of other if you want to call them credits or activities that she did in the name of civil rights. And it's true. It's good to. I don't know whether anyone mentioned her either. I wasn't really. I had to look it up now just to look into her. I'm sure I've heard of her before, but didn't really know any date information.
Well, I appreciate that because when the other caller mentioned her, I didn't know. I didn't put her in a time frame. But when you say that she only passed recently, that's it kind of puts it.
Right.
She was a fairly contemporary figure, even if she did live into her 90s. That still made her a fairly contemporary figure. That's interesting.
Yes. So the date, again, was December the 14th of 2022. So it was kind of recent. Katherine Johnson, I want to bring up her just really, really quickly. And I wasn't familiar, to be honest, until I saw the movie Hidden Figures with Taraji. But Katherine Johnson herself, after I learned about her, and there were the other young ladies as well, she was also in a nursing home in her last days, from what I understand. I learned that prior to her passing away, because once I looked and searched to see where she was, because I wanted to see if I could somehow meet up with her and perhaps do a little maybe interview or something. But she was a nursing home in Virginia, or either it was West Virginia, which is bordering Pennsylvania.
Right.
So I thought that would be very possible to get over there. But time went by, and she passed away. I don't know the circumstances of what put these great women in nursing homes. Like, that's probably maybe an overall decision with the families or not, or what they felt was something that's workable for them all. Not sure. But as long as I believe we should all lift up their names when they're alive as well, support them, and in our own ways become, not them, but be active ourselves in the day-to-day fight for civil rights and just equal rights. But more importantly, to build our own. That's where I really stand. Build our own, have our own communities. A real community is when you see block to block to block of people, not just people of color, I'll be specific, black people, African-American people, owning the ground that they drive on, the stores that they go to, building the stores, owning the cities, the municipal buildings, if they're running them better than what we see, hospitals, stores. That's a real community. I just want to elaborate a little bit more, and I know I'm going spiraling a little further out there. But yes, we should honor them. We should honor those who are alive. And not only that, be as inclusive or as productive as we can for our rights. And again, more importantly, build our own so we don't have to ask or need for others.
I appreciate that.
Thank you for the show, for having the show. I do appreciate that.
Well, and I thank you for participating. And look, I agree with everything we just said. I mean, I think we one of the things that's really lacking, and I say the same thing about where I live, even in Native communities, is we don't have as solid a sense of community as we should. And certainly, you know, when you get into urban environments, I mean, look, there are people who don't know the people who live in the same building as they do. So what we lack in community and what we lack in supporting each other as a part of a community and I don't mean just, you know, all being renters like the caller said. I mean, we do need to have stock in our community, and when I say stock, I mean we need to have ownership. We need to have teachers that look like us. We need to have storekeeps that look like us. We need to have people within our community, and you know, we can make this a black or white thing, but this is what we need to do. Gentrification isn't just about white people, you know, buying up black properties or buying up black neighborhoods. Gentrification is a bigger issue than that, and it's about people being dismissed because of the elements of society that work to keep people oppressed and keep people down on the bottom rungs of society. So we need to do more as a community to lift each other up. And I also agree that we need to make sure that even when we see a person who has been a high achiever, the problem is it's easy to recognize them while they're while they're on a magazine cover or when they're in the newspaper. But, you know, some of the saddest stories I've ever heard is how people spend the last days of their lives because they either didn't have anybody around them or circumstances took them from that one time high spot within, you know, with recognition, and somehow forgot them. So I agree with you, and I appreciate the call. I really do appreciate the call. Let me remind people that we are on WBAI in New York City. I've had the distinct honor of being on this radio station for I don't even know how many years now. It's been over a decade, and you know, for those who are unfamiliar with me, I first sat in for Teokusin Ghost Horse as a guest host for his indigenous radio station, his first Voices, and then I hosted his program for a year that he needed to take some time off, and then when Teokusin came back, the program director at the time, Mario Murillo, gave me the opportunity to start hosting my own show, and I've been doing so ever since. And you know, I came into this position originally just doing pure talkback radio, and it was always going to have a native, you know, slant to it. But I remember when Mario said, you know, offer a subject and try to keep it narrow there and don't let people get off on tangents. And I said, you know what, Mario, let me let people go where they want to go. And that's why I don't mind when we're talking about a specific topic, if we go off script a little bit. I think when I know, because oftentimes people want to try to call in, but you know, they either don't get through for whatever reason. And you know, so if it's a week later or 2 weeks later, like if you want to talk about something I've talked about in the past, I appreciate the suggestions that people make, and I appreciate the commentary. And as I always say, my show is about conversation. It's not about conversion. I'm not trying to make everybody see things my way. But I think it's important that people understand that there is a view that they may not have been familiar with. That's what I bring to WBAI. I bring a native view, not the native view. I'm not speaking for all Native people with this show, but I am. I do live on a Native territory. My wife is Native. My kids are Native. You know, I'm an advocate on many different issues that range everything from the mascot issue to taxation and gaming. So I am plugged in on many Native issues. So when I offer an opinion, it's not an opinion that's coming from somebody who just read something in a book. And so I appreciate that listeners do call into the show and express their gratitude for this show being here. But I'm going to remind people, the best way to express your gratitude is to make a donation to the WBAI in the name of the show. You know, call the pledge line and let them know that you're contributing in the name of Resistance Radio with John Cain. And that number again, 212-209-2950, or go online to give to WBAI.org. I greatly appreciate it. I mean, we're getting at a place now where if WBAI isn't generating the revenue that they need to on a show-by-show basis, you know, some of us risk going away. And I don't know. I don't keep a running tally on who calls or how much anybody contributes. I do have some options that I may need to pursue if things get a little dicey, but my biggest ask and my best ask is of you, is that you support this radio station. And when, you know, you can support as many programs as you want. But I do ask that if you listen to this program and you like what I present, or you like the opportunity to weigh in yourselves on this program, that you contribute to the station. And, you know, of course, I'm on WPFW in Washington, D.C. as well. And I also try to make the show available. I put it up as a Facebook live stream. I take the audio and I post it up as a podcast. You can find that podcast by just asking your smart speaker or going online and search Resistance Radio with John Cain podcast, and it'll show up. And, of course, you can always use the station's archives to look at previously aired shows. But I try to make it available. I try to make the conversation available, and I try to make the conversation listenable. I'm not trying to speak over anybody's head, and I'm certainly not trying to shout anybody down. This is what I try to bring to this to this platform, to this station, and frankly to New York City. And I hope real soon that I can start looking at the possibility of making the trip to New York City. In fact, I may be coming down to Westchester County at the end of the month for an event, and I'll let you know more about that as that comes to be. But I want to thank you for, I want to thank you guys for listening to the station and for contributing. And again, I think I'm off next week in New York. I still will be doing a show and it'll broadcast in Washington. So we'll see you the next time. But this is John Cain. I want to say thank you, Yahweh. And this is Resistance Radio.